This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
For this month's Jodbyte, I'm speaking to Professor Ben Stappers here at Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics, who's had a press release recently about a very unusual type of pulsar. So Ben, could you tell us a little bit about what's going on with that one?
Yeah, the press release was about a pulsar in a binary system. The pulsar is called PSR J1023+0038, which basically just gives you its address in the sky. It's a millisecond pulsar, so it rotates extremely rapidly. The period is in fact around about 1.7 milliseconds. And it's in a binary system where the two stars orbit each other once every 4.8 hours. And it has a very low mass companion star. And the companion star in the radio eclipses the radio emission. So every orbit, for around about 10% of the orbit, the radio emission is partially eclipsed by what we believe is a wind from the companion star. So that's the basic system as it stands.
So it's really extreme. I mean, you're talking about 1.7 milliseconds, so it's going round hundreds of times a second. And not only that, but also orbiting the star in only a few hours.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's an exceptional system in that sense. There are a handful of these type of systems known now. What makes this system stand out even more is that not only is it in this binary system, but we believe that less than 20 years ago, it was actually still something called an X-ray binary. So in fact, it was first detected and identified as a completely different type of source. It was first thought to be a cataclysmic variable, and then maybe it was thought to be a low-mass X-ray binary, because it was first identified through its X-ray emission and the fact that it had a companion star. And so actually quite a lot was known about the optical light from the companion star before it was serendipitously discovered as a radio pulsar. So in the mid-2000s, it was discovered as a radio pulsar, and then they got the position for it, and they looked in the literature like every good astronomer should, and discovered, hey, look, somebody thought there was this interesting source here before, but it had quite different characteristics. So it looks like when they found it, it had transitioned from being an X-ray source to a radio pulsar. And this is very interesting because we think that the way that millisecond pulsars form is that you have a neutron star, which may or may not have been a pulsar in the past, in a binary system with another low-mass star, or lower-mass star, I should say. Once that lower-mass star evolves, material from that star is more gravitationally attracted to the neutron star. It can form an accretion disk around the neutron star, and then ultimately matter can accrete onto the neutron star. And when that matter accretes onto the neutron star, it transfers angular momentum, and that causes the neutron star to be spun up. Okay, so that's how we get these so-called millisecond pulsars, and sometimes they're referred to as being reborn or something like that. And so during this X-ray phase, this low-mass X-ray binary phase, so named because it predominantly emits in the X-rays, and the X-rays either are coming from the accretion disk itself, or, as was discovered in around about 1998, I think it was, material from the accretion disk can actually fall onto the poles of the neutron star, and you can actually get millisecond X-ray pulsations. So the discovery of this particular source, which has a nickname SACS-J1808, when that was discovered, it was sort of seen to be strong confirmation that this idea that you go from a neutron star in a binary with a companion star through a low-mass X-ray binary phase, and then at the end you come out the other side and you have a millisecond pulsar, either with a companion star, which can be a range of different things, or if, depending on the system, you can actually completely destroy the companion star, and so you end up with an isolated millisecond pulsar. So this was the situation up until around about June of last year.
So there was just one system that had ever been observed to actually be making that transition from the X-rays to radio waves.
Yeah, at that time. Subsequent to that, there is another one, maybe two systems now. There's one in a globular cluster. It's called M28I, and that had gone the other way, as it were. And then subsequent to new work on this system, we think there's another system that looks like it's probably transitioning, but we need to catch it and go back again to be able to be sure that it's definitely transitioned.
So what's particularly interesting about the system that you've discovered and that's being featured in the press release and in a paper?
Yeah, so one of my collaborators actually discovered the source originally. So what we discovered about the source was using the Lovell telescope at Jodrell Bank, we regularly time hundreds of pulsars, and this is one of the ones we look at often. And we suddenly realized that we weren't seeing the pulsar anymore. And while it's in an eclipsing system, so occasionally you expect not to see the pulsar, our observations were long enough and there were enough of them that we were suddenly alerted to thinking, oh my goodness, what's happened? Our colleagues in the Netherlands also look at it with the Westerbork synthesis telescope, and they too noticed when we alerted them that, yes, they hadn't seen it for a little while. And we were able to narrow it down to within a couple of week period when it actually apparently turned off as a radio source. Now, I say turned off, we actually don't know if it's stopped emitting in the radio, but we certainly can't detect the radio emission anymore. And Archibald, working at Astron in the Netherlands, noticed that at the same time, there was a dramatic increase in the gamma ray flux from this source. And then further work showed us that Alessandro Petruno, working also in the Netherlands, he looked in the X-rays with SWIFT and noticed also that the X-ray behavior had changed. Subsequently, with optical follow-up of the companion star, we were able to show that the system once again had an accretion disk. So we'd lost the radio emission, and we had evidence for an accretion disk in the system. And so it apparently completed at least one cycle of this going from low-mass X-ray binary, radio pulsar, radio millisecond pulsar, and apparently back to a low-mass X-ray binary phase, although it's currently not accreting. The neutron star is not accreting. Otherwise, we'd expect the X-ray emission to be much brighter than it currently is. So this is sort of interesting. It means it's unclear whether we're at the end of this whole LMXB phase, and so it's sort of in an unstable situation where subtle changes in the mass loss rate of the companion star, either due to temperature or tidal interactions, cause it to lose more mass, which means that that suppresses the wind from the pulsar so that it overcomes the pressure from the wind. It can form an accretion disk again, and then we end up with the situation that we have now. So that's why it's particularly interesting.
Do we think it goes through a long period of accretion and then at the end it can seesaw back and forth and then at some point emerges a radio pulsar? How long does that kind of period of accretion actually last for?
Yeah, that's a very good question. To be fair, I don't think we know the answer. I mean, the low-mass X-ray binary phase, we have a reasonable idea about how long that lasts overall based on, we know typically how much you have to spin up the star. You can work out for reasonable efficiency of spin up. You can work out how much mass that is and the mass accretion rates and things like that. So you get a lifetime for that. And it's not actually very long compared to the entire lifetime of millisecond pulsars in general. So millisecond pulsars tend to be a billion years old or more. And whereas the LMXB phase is probably tens of millions of years. So it could be, as you say, that we're right at the end of that phase, and so that's we end up this oscillation stage. It could be very interesting if this is the case. Well, it is very interesting if this is the case, because this would basically be the birth of a millisecond pulsar that we're seeing here. And so we'd know a lot about the initial conditions in millisecond pulsars. As I mentioned, most of the ones we've discovered are much older, and so they've already spun down, their periods have increased from the maximum period they had when they were born. Whereas this one we're maybe seeing at its maximum period. It's also yet to be seen whether this will actually start accreting again and whether we'll see if it comes back as a radio pulsar or we are able to detect pulsations in the X-rays, whether or not the spin period has been affected by this phase that it's currently in now.
Right, so we'll be able to perhaps measure it spinning faster if we're lucky.
It may, who knows, but if accretion takes place, it may end up coming out the other side spinning faster than it currently is.
And that brings me on to another interesting question when you're talking about the fact that there's a number of millisecond pulsars out there, so obviously systems can evolve into that. How might we expect this system to end up? And also related to that, how on earth did it get into the state it's in now in the first place? Because you've got a pulsar which at some point has been creating the supernova explosion, and yet it somehow ended up really, really close to this companion star. So do we have any idea how a system like this gets to where it is and where it's going to?
In fact, we do, I think. I mean, I think the models are quite robust in terms of understanding how we get to, at least to the LMXB phase, and probably after that. And basically, it's relatively sensitive to the initial conditions of the binary system, but the process of accretion itself can generate the compactness that we see now.
When the supernova happened that made the neutron star, they wouldn't have been as close together at that time.
No, that's right. That's right. I mean, in general, they would have been further apart. And the companion star would have evolved and expanded rapidly, and so would have been much larger than it currently is. And that would have allowed it to, the accretion phase to begin, and that accretion phase would have affected the evolution. That part of it's reasonably well understood. The bits that aren't well understood are, for example, as listeners may know, normal radio pulsars have very strong magnetic fields, 10 to the 12 Gauss or something like that, and millisecond pulsars have something like 10 to the 8 Gauss. So if this neutron star had been a normal pulsar, how do we go between these two different fields? And is that somehow related to this whole phase that we're looking at now, the slow mass X-ray binary phase? What does that do to the magnetic field strength? So that's an interesting area. And again, this whole business about what are the birth periods of millisecond pulsars is very interesting, because that can have an influence on the equation of state. So that the interior of the neutron star, how stiff that can be, depends very strongly on what the most rapid rotation rate is for any given neutron star. And so knowing what their birth periods is very interesting.
To see if they really ever get spun up, I guess, to their absolute limit.
Yes, that's right.
Physically.
Yes. Yeah, well, yes. Whether they, I'm not sure they will ever get to break up, but who knows. But certainly this 1.7 millisecond pulsar, I'm not sure exactly where it ranks in the list, but it's within a few of the fastest spinning, so it's one of the most rapid spinning ones we know about already. So it's interesting, if this is really where it was born, as it were, then maybe there aren't many things that spin more rapidly than this that exist.
And just as a last question, what actually happens to the material when it's falling from the star onto the pulsar? Presumably it's going very quickly by the time it hits the pulsar. Does it have to pass through a magnetic field of the pulsar as well?
Yeah, again, like I say, first you have to have this accretion disk. Otherwise, it'll just spit straight it back out of the system again because of the angular momentum problem. And so it forms an accretion disk. And then, indeed, how you accrete on a strongly magnetized object is an area of research. It's something that people work on. And then, so it's quite possible that you need to fill the accretion disk enough that it starts to penetrate what we call the magnetosphere in order to be able to accrete directly onto the neutron star. It may also be the case, and we see this in other neutron stars, that you can accrete onto the poles via something called a propeller mechanism. And so when it accretes onto the poles, that gives you the possibility to actually see these millisecond pulsations that I was talking about before in the X-rays. So that sort of interaction is actually what we're able to study right now. If the system stays like stable like it is for now, what's happening? Is it just filling up the disk slowly but surely? And will it fill the disk enough that it overcomes the boundaries associated with the magnetic field such that it can actually accrete? Or what exactly is going to happen in the next phase? That's why that's particularly interesting. And, you know, we hope that this happens on a reasonable timescale. As you can imagine, for a phase in the life of the system, compared to the billions of years it's short, it's still millions of years. And so for us as astronomers to be able to see this process happening on a human timescale is actually very interesting and gives us a unique chance to try and, in one object, see it go through all these different phases that we see other objects in.
So we'll be keeping an eye, presumably, to see if the radio emission switches back on.
Yes, very much so. So, you know, we're continuing to monitor the source. It might seem crazy, but we know we're observing to see nothing. But the main reason we're doing that is because we want to catch the moment when it turns back on as precisely as we possibly can, and then again trigger looking in X-rays and optical gamma rays, all those sorts of things, to be able to say what has happened if and when we transition back to being a radio pulsar.
Fantastic. Well, good luck with finding that radio pulsar re-emerging.
Thank you very much.